Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and this is our continuing series on Mythosophia, delving into the depths, if you will, of myth and wisdom. And we're going to be talking today about sports and how it plays into the whole conversation. My co-host on these programs is Will Lynn. He's working on his PhD in mythology. Welcome back to the program, Will.
Thanks.
It's great to have you back here in Santa Barbara as we continue this. I can't believe this is our halfway mark.
Yeah.
This is amazing. And today's program is really interesting. I'm not a huge sports fan. I love baseball. I can sit and watch any game.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. I don't care who the teams are. I might choose a particular mm-hmm. team as the game progresses. But I, and of course, growing up in Arizona, didn't have a baseball team until 98.
Right.
And then the next thing I know, I can say I'm from a World Series town,
yeah.
which is kind of exciting. Of course, folks here in California, mm-hmm. you have teams up and down the coast. And, mm-hmm. of course, the Dodgers are probably at the top of that list.
Right.
But then, of course, we have all the other sports as well. It's just mm-hmm. not relegated to baseball, basketball, mm-hmm. football, hockey, soccer. And, of course, this time of the year,
mm-hmm.
they're playing the World Cup down in South America, in Brazil. And that's an amazing thing to watch. I mean, I can walk into just about any restaurant nowadays with the mm-hmm. giant screens, and you're mesmerized.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how the game is going. You're just mesmerized by the spectacle. And the Olympics will be coming up again.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, you just tune in a little bit, and you're drawn right into that whole
Absolutely.
Genre. So we're going to talk about how that plays into mythology.
That's...
So give us a little primer, if you will, about this connection between mythology and sports.
Well, first, I do want to comment on what you're saying about the spectacle nature is one of the big things I want to ask about. And spectacle has always been, one of the, I don't want to say always, those are dangerous words, but a huge part of mythology and a huge part of religion is the spectacle itself. And we have a lot of secular spectacles today, and sports is a big one. One of the things that I want to point out is that, we could really do a lot of work to try and connect mythology to sports, but that could also be a little bit obnoxious, and I don't think it's necessary. We shouldn't need to do that, because really, sports, they already are carrying settings, symbols, costumes, characters, heroes, mentors, villains, backstories, future implications, audience, ritual, cultural impact, nostalgia, memory. These elements are equally essential to global mythologies and international sporting events. So I don't want to overstretch the mythology thing, because just talking about international sports, every dynamic of it's going to be in the territory of the mythic. And I also, on that note, I think memory is very honest. What you remember for a reason. And I think that strong symbols, strong narratives, strong characters, these make for strong memories. And so when we, instead of asking John, the most mythic thing he remembers or something like that, we'll just trust that the strongest memories implicitly carry mythic qualities, and that's what makes them such strong memories.
Well, I know that as far as strong memories are concerned, when you bring that to mind, one of the first, of course, is the end of Game 7 against the New York Yankees as the Arizona Diamondbacks were playing in the World Series, mm-hmm. and they were playing at Bob, all I can remember, the guy's last name, I think it was Gonzalez, but they called him Gonzo.
Mm-hmm.
And he hit a bloop single out
mm-hmm.
into left center.
Hmm.
It dropped. It drove in the winning run. And the next thing you knew, everybody was just celebrating.
Wild elation.
I had a very good friend from New York
mm-hmm.
who was obviously rooting for the Yankees. And when it was all said and done, he would say to me, and I'm probably more tongue-in-cheek, "Oh, that was a fluke."
Right, right.
And I thought, okay, they played 7 games.
Uh-huh.
They split the first 6. How is that a fluke?
Well, you know, rivalries is one of the most interesting things here. Rivalries is fun. I mean, rivalry can be very violent and dangerous, and there are certainly riots, and there have been problems even within the last decade in California with sports fans going against each other. On the other hand, friendly rivalries, when you shake the hands of the players you just played against, when you can take jeers at a team you know is good and make fun of them for being bad just because they're not. You know, those kind of rivalries are beautiful things. And one of the things that may come up is how sports have participated in a way, surrogate warriorism, surrogate warfare in a way, especially international sports. Mm-hmm. Not that you're actually, not that the outcomes have anything to do with territories gained or something like this, but the desire to compete is far more powerful. I don't say more, but is separate than the mm-hmm. desire to go to war, and they often come together. And giving the outlet for competition, healthy competition, is really really good thing.
Yeah, then that's an interesting perspective because we've had Olympic games that have been mm-hmm. held during wartime.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, most people think, of course, of the games back in the late 30s, and Jesse Owens winning in front
Black
of Hitler
glove and
and all of that. And sometimes the comment is made by many people, why can't we solve this conflict just through, you know, some form of athletic competition?
Yeah.
And whoever wins, that's it. And that way there are so fewer deaths and injuries.
I really wish I could remember what culture it was, but I remember reading about an old culture that they didn't go to war. They literally played tag.
You know,
they literally, and then reductions of this into the idea of smaller ideas of this along the lines of like you don't stab somebody to kill them, you know, you tag, you're out, you know, you get them with your sword. Like that war wasn't always we have to kill every man, woman, and child to make sure that they don't come back, as we remember in the ancient wars of Troy or something like
right.
that. It can be a game.
Yeah. And it's very interesting how even different versions of some of our more violent sports mm-hmm. like football, mm-hmm. they have flag football where
right.
you reach out and you grab the flag.
Right.
There's no tackling.
Right.
And so there's obviously fewer injuries, potentially fewer injuries. And there are folks who just, you know, don't want to go there. Now, there's another aspect mm-hmm. of this mythology and sports when it comes to the mascot and or the name of the team
mm-hmm.
and how that's chosen and how it's ingrained into the public psyche. And obviously, I have a feeling we're going to have to talk about the controversy that is brewing even as we speak.
Over some of the
yeah. names, some of the symbolism.
Culturally important.
And the almost seeming dichotomy between those who are offended by a mm-hmm. given name and or symbolism
mm-hmm.
and even some of the groups who are depicted in this
yeah.
name and symbolism who are not. It's Oof. Like you have an organization that says uh-huh. this is offensive, but the very people who are supposedly being offended aren't.
May not be, right. You know, I actually I'm a fan of the Atlanta Braves, and mm-hmm. so they're a relevant team when it comes to this. They used to have a mascot named Chief Nakahoma,
mm-hmm.
which is a little funny, but there's probably a good reason why they got rid of that mascot.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I don't think that the chop is going anywhere, the tomahawk chop.
Yeah.
And I think that, in fact, the blog site that I participate in, the Atlanta Braves blog site, is called Talking Chop. And so it does raise some because this is where it's tricky. Literally, these mascots have become as much a part of a different culture than the culture where they, you know, may have originated or may have that they're pointing towards. So,
mm-hmm.
so while you're talking, I'm talking about a Native American culture that may relate to the Redskins. You also have an intense Redskins culture,
yeah.
and of course, you should not. I'm not saying you should champion the Redskins culture over the Native Americans, but it is a very much a culture built around the characters, teams.
I heard a comment not too long ago that said that this whole controversy has taken the mascot, the name, the symbol, the image way out of context.
Mm-hmm.
Because the only reason why a football team would choose a particular symbol or image is to show their toughness.
Right, their pride and strength. And right.
So when you think about the Buffalo Bills, the Buffalo mm-hmm. Bills,
right.
the New York Giants,
right.
the San Francisco Giants, et cetera, but when you think about the Washington Redskins or even mm-hmm. the Atlanta Braves,
right.
that was chosen as a sign of strength, of power.
There's something kind of bitter, perhaps, about the fact that one of the real enduring legacies of the Native Americans in this country is the bravery that became remembered as these icons of these sports teams. Very much huge legacy.
I can see
that. And that's
that.
An expression, but it is,
but
for
what
better
about
and
the
worse.
Animal, what about the animal rights people? You
right.
got the D-backs, the Diamondbacks,
honestly,
the Bills, the Buffalo. And
I honestly don't think a snake cares. Yeah, I do care a lot more about whether a person is offended, but
I agree. We get off on all of these different tangents,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not taking a position either way, because
mm-hmm.
the league's going to do what it's going to do, and the people are going to do what
right.
they're going to do. I certainly don't want people to be offended,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, maybe we need to look at these kinds of things a little bit more logically and realistically, if
yeah.
we're going to play these games, and they are games.
Totally.
Let's shift into
yeah.
that realm. We're talking about men and women because
mm-hmm.
there's also other sports like tennis
mm-hmm.
and others as well that these adults
mm-hmm.
get to play a game.
Yeah.
And it's a job.
Those are the best speeches in movies when the kid
yeah.
reminds the players, remember, you're a bunch of grown men playing a game.
Yeah.
And it's true. It is a game. And it's what a privilege to get to play games, and get to compete like that. How many of us grew up wishing that would be what we would grow up and get to do, play games.
Exactly.
Especially those.
And it even transitions into, as you've already alluded to, television and movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wanted to start my own collection
mm-hmm.
of baseball movies.
Mm-hmm.
And some would say, well, of course, your first one's going to be Field of Dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily.
Well, let's ask John Powers maybe about The Natural. I've heard him mention it before, and that's a great one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A pitcher who has been having a great season, then
mm-hmm.
destroys his arm and manages to come back.
And here's the cool thing about that one, too, is that one, I actually read that one in my Arthurian legend class. I read the book, and it was because that book, I think Bernard Malamud, was coming out of a sports writing tradition where the sports writing was very strong. And he took the Grail legends of the Wasteland and the Fisher King, and he made it so that the field, no grass would grow on the field, and the coach was always kind of ailing, and he took these incredible Arthurian elements and Grail elements. Excalibur was the bat, and really enriched a story of baseball into what's become, a real myth. I mean, it's a heck of a story for baseball players.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and of course, I think back to going back to where we started at the beginning of the segment about memory. Obviously, the
mm-hmm.
the night that the D-backs won the series. But then I go back another 14 years from there, 15 years from that point.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 86. And it was the Dodgers and the Oakland A's.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a World Series, and it was only game one, which was real interesting.
Hmm.
And Jose Canseco hit a home run that actually hit a camera.
Huh.
And in the ninth inning, and this was one of those classic moments.
Yeah.
Two men on, two out.
Yep.
I mean, and he was down to a full count.
Yep.
And Kurt Gibson, I called him Gimpy Gibson,
uh-huh.
hits a home run almost exactly to the same spot
hmm.
and wins that game, which propelled the Dodgers into winning that series, winning the World Series that year. But I remember that. And what's funny is how
yeah.
critical that game became, that moment became,
mm-hmm.
and ingrained in my brain
mm-hmm.
as one of those classic moments.
And I can tell you, Braves fans certainly have a number of those too. They say when Sid slid, you know, Sid Bream's slide. So we should get to John.
Yeah.
But real quick, before we introduce
yes.
him and coming back, I do just want to add that just a couple notes. One, Chris Downing has agreed to interview to an interview in the fall, and that's really exciting news. She's a professor at Pacifica, Pacifica Graduate Institute, and the first woman to be elected president of the American Academy of Religion. She's given credit for revolutionizing the genre of memoir, and her archives are housed alongside those of Joseph Campbell, James Hillman, Maria Gimbutas at Opus Archives. So that's going to be a wonderful interview.
Looking forward to that one as well. All right, well, we're going to bring John Powers on in a moment. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is Mythosophia, researching and searching into the depths of mythology here on Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan, and we will be right back.
Mills is coming on.
Oh. Greer's putting the ball on a play. He gets it out deep, and Havlicek steals it. Havlicek stole the ball.
And there's a collision. It's cut out of the air. The ball is pulled in by Franco Harris. Harris is going for a touchdown.
5 seconds left in the game. Do you believe in miracles? Yes!
Jordan, open. Chicago with the lead.
Cruzando el servicio, el primer palo, gol.
Now Babe Ruth is turning out towards center field, and he's yelling at the Cubs that the next pitch over is going out in the center field. Now he's looking toward the stand. And there's the pitch to Connors, ball two and strike two. It's coming. Babe Ruth connects, and there it goes. The ball is going high into the center field stand, into the scoreboard, and it's a home run.
167 to 146. Now let's see if they found somebody quick. Rogers throws long to Chamberlain. He's got it. He's trying to get up. He shoots. No good. The rebound, Luckenbill. Back to Chamberlain. He shoots up. No good. In and out. The rebound, Luckenbill. Back to Rucklick. Into Chamberlain. He made it.
Sunshine on the diamond just an hour ago. What a day for a ball game. Got me a hot dog and a Coke. Now they're covering up the infield. The umpire has called play. Search my pocket for my rain check. Lord, I hate these rain delays. But life's a lot like baseball, if you know what I'm talking about. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Sometimes you're rain now.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is Mythosophia, sixth part in our 12-part series. Today, it's sports and mythology. I'm here with my co-host, Will Lynn. He is a PhD candidate, is kind of how I want to phrase it these days, in process. I'm looking forward to, what I look forward to reading it?
I think so. I hope so.
All right. Very good. We have a special guest on the line, and the man is an award winner, so let's introduce him now.
So John Powers is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author who's written for the Boston Globe for over 40 years. He also writes for Harvard Magazine, has authored 8 books, and covered sporting events in 5 continents, including the Summer and Winter Olympics, as well as the World Cup. In fact, he's covering the World Cup right now, so we are especially grateful for our time with him. Welcome, John.
How are you guys? It's lovely here in the East. Sunny, and summer's here.
Well, it's always like that here.
Now, that's one of the interesting things that you have available to you that maybe you didn't at the beginning of your career as a sports writer and so forth, is the technology has changed to where you can cover anything, anywhere, from wherever you are.
That's right. As a matter of fact, we were doing this. I had covered 5 World Cups in a row.
Wow.
And the last World Cup in 2010 in South Africa, it was so expensive that we said, why don't you just write columns from here? So we didn't have a television at our place on Cape Cod, so I went to a local bar and watched it there. And then I'd drive home to my house and then have the quotes from the U.S. guys would be on the wire. And it was so realistic that my wife was getting invitations. Oh, it must be so hard to have John, in South Africa. So what are you talking about? John's firing up the grill right outside. But I think as long as you are reasonably informed and you're able to keep up with it, you don't have to necessarily be there. I'm not always sure how I feel about that. I mean, I think it's always better to be there, get the flavor and all of that. But at least it's now possible, not just to watch it, but to have a conversation globally with people on this.
Do you think that's partially because there are that many more people covering all these events, that if you want content, you don't have to go and make sure you get all the details? Somebody's going to get them and make them available?
I think that's partly true. Also, access is much more limited now than it ever was.
Huh.
I used to travel with the Celtics back in the late 70s. And Bill Simmons, who I think everyone knows these days, wrote a book about basketball. And he read a book I'd written on a year with the Celtics.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, can you believe John Powers not only flew with the team, he had dinner with the players?
Huh.
That's, back then we all did that. The idea that you would do that now, that you would have that much access, is almost unheard of. And teams basically now, because they can do through social media and their websites, they can communicate directly with the fan. They don't need the media as an intermediary anymore.
But let me ask you in that light, how connected are the fans to the players? Because it seems as though it doesn't seem like there's a real contact being made like you would if you went
like
to the
illusion or something.
Exactly.
That's right. As a matter of fact, it's the same thing now when we're talking about how many friends you have on Facebook. You may have 700 mm-hmm. friends. How many do you actually know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
mm-hmm. And I think here there was much more, at least there was a perception that you could be close to the player. There wasn't the gulf. Players made themselves more available.
Yeah.
Then they do now.
Is that also
part, now? Athletes are much more wary than they were. If an athlete is having a drink in a bar, someone's going to put that on the web.
How much did the John Rocker interview have to do with that massive shift in the attitude of sports of athletes and their relationship with authors?
I think it made them more wary. Just look recently what happened with Donald Sterling. His mistress has mm-hmm. a phone call that everyone thinks is private, and he has to sell his team because of it.
Right.
The fact is that is probably the way he felt, and it certainly is a way that no owner or anybody in America should feel. But the fact that he had no idea that would ever happen to him, that would have been impossible 20 or 30 years ago.
But when you start looking at the fan, and especially the younger fans, especially the kids, and you see these commercials, I forget what the football player's name was who tossed the towel to the kid.
Mm-hmm.
Here, kid.
Mean Joe Green.
Joe Green. You couldn't have that today.
No.
And in a way, technology has actually separated us from our iconic heroes, or at least the ones that we perceive as heroes.
It has. Although, what's interesting, when I was thinking about the whole mythology, when I was growing up, The biggest myth of all was Babe Ruth. And actually, Babe died the year that I was born.
I want to ask you more about that. Go on.
And the fact is that what you find out as a sports writer, especially talking to people who knew Babe, everything that you thought you believed about him probably was not true, or at least wasn't exactly that true. He didn't really call his shot. At least that's what people who were there say. His big tummy ache wasn't from eating too many hot dogs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what we found, for example, the mythology that people want to believe, they often don't want to know what the real truth is. And what I always found when people, people would ask me about athletes, they wanted their perceptions confirmed.
Interesting. Don't tell me George Washington didn't cut down a cherry tree.
Well, absolutely. Well, for example, here, as you know, I mean, the Red Sox-Yankees, it's like Athens and Sparta. And for many years, they would come down to the final week going for the divisional title, and I would go down to New York and cover the Yankees for the final week. They were wonderful to deal with. Very, very professional. You know, Derek Jeter was an absolute delight, and
That's
Joe Torre. And the Sox fans did not want to hear that. I mean, you couldn't get them to believe that Derek Jeter was even human, much less a nice guy.
Well, so speaking of more modern figures, and while we're still talking about Babe Ruth, is Big Poppy the Babe now in Boston?
Oh, yeah. You know, what's interesting is a lot of the same feeling was here. His name was mentioned in the congressional report
Wow.
as someone who had been using drugs.
Oh,
and it came out that he, Manny Ramirez, and you know, and many others were involved with it. But the fact is that if you ask the Red Sox fans, does that affect how you felt about winning the World Series with these guys? They said, well, everybody else is doing it too.
Right.
But certainly Pappy, well, we just saw this last night. The Red Sox were deadlocked in a 1-0 game. He hits a home run. Next guy hits a home run, it's over. Pappy still does that.
Yeah.
He is an icon here. And he's also a very popular guy anyway.
Mm-hmm.
One reason why he's open to people. You may have seen last year after the marathon bombings and the Red Sox came back. And,
yeah.
Pappy kind of addressed it, and he basically dropped the F-bomb.
Mm-hmm.
But you could buy T-shirts that had what Pappy said. You know, this is our effing city. And the thing is, he's not from here. He's from the Dominican Republic. But he has been taken in as a Bostonian, and when you look at icons, he is up there with Tom Brady, certainly, you know, and Patrice Bergeron, the Bruins, and you know, all the heroes.
But what about those heroes, those icons that we cherished as kids or young adults, that later on in life they do something and that's what they're remembered for? I think about the first one that comes to mind is Pete Rose. Great baseball player. As far as we know, he wasn't taking any drugs, performance-enhancing chemicals or what have you. The thing that got him into trouble was supposedly that he placed wagers that he should not have placed against it, for or against what have you. And it's like, well, what about his career? Doesn't that count for something? And most people say, nah, because of what he did.
Right.
And it's wow.
Well, you know what? It gets really murky. I did a big story last year around this time on the four major professional halls of fame and what it takes to get into them.
Okay.
And the big debate was, should people who were taking steroids be in the Hall of Fame?
Right.
And even more so, what happens if, for example, in football, you're a fantastic player, you get out later, you get arrested for selling drugs?
Right.
Do we have a morals clause here? And it comes down to being a hero. You need to be an upright person.
Not just a good player.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember it was funny because we were always talking about this as sports writers. You know, so-and-so doesn't talk to the media. Does that make him a bad guy? And I think Red Smith, who was a long time, famous New York Times columnist, and even before that for other people, he said, they are what they do. And what he basically meant in terms of being an athlete, it's what they do, in between the white lines that matters. Mm-hmm. What they do in their private life, at least for our purposes, doesn't matter. But I think the fans want to say, because he's a great athlete, he also must be a great human being and a role model.
Mm-hmm. So there's actually some misinformation on the part of the public, or maybe misperception or misperceiving of these sports icons that needs some adjusting.
But
or
does
correcting.
It? Here's the question, you know, because kids are looking up to these people as role models anyway.
Right.
Then,
well, yeah, but Charles Barkley said he wasn't a role model.
But that's not, I mean, he can't say that. I mean, he can say that, but he can't make that true. So from a sports writer's point of view, if a guy is going to be a role model anyway, how do you take that into consideration when you're writing about him, even if he's not the best the best human being?
Well, I think that's, you know, it's funny. It's an issue that you dealt with not just in sports, but in politics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You go back now and you read about what John F. Kennedy did and what FDR did and many other politicians. And you say, well, why wasn't this reported at the time? And the feeling was, in many cases, it wasn't reported because you would lose access if you ever printed that.
Mm.
And also because there was a sense that it wasn't fair game, that it wasn't part of what he did in his office, that if a president had a girlfriend on the side but was, leading the country well, we should take that into account. These are not perfect. These are not plaster saints, as we say.
Right. And it's only with such radical transparency that we seem to be having these kinds of demands on people that we know everything about all their lives if we're going to believe in them.
Go ahead, John.
Well, and again, I think, you know, as a society, you have to decide.
Yeah.
Why do we consider people role models, and do we really want to know the truth?
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many things. Everyone said no one wants to see laws or sausages made, and the same goes to do with journalism. And there are many other things. If you look at the brutality in some cases that it takes to produce an athlete, you look at, how they are trained and beaten in some cases, not necessarily in America.
Or not paid.
Minor
league baseball.
Do you really want to know what goes into this?
Well, but what do you think that, let me ask you, John, if you think that it's an appropriate mental adjustment for the fan to start to acknowledge, yes, he's an incredible athlete. I love watching him or her on the field. And he's also, she's also a human being with the same character, personality, and flaws that I have as a fan.
Well, you know, I see. I think that is the view of a maturing country. And I think one of the things that makes America different is we do believe in the mythology because in many cases it works. The idea that you can come here with nothing and within a generation you can become the president or you can become the head of a major company and that all of your children will live wonderfully in a way they never could have. All that's true, but it also leads to a mythology where people don't want to necessarily hear that it doesn't happen or it doesn't happen for a lot of people. And I think that, it was funny. I was in Europe when the Monica Lewinsky thing happened with Bill Clinton. And the feeling of the French was, well, of course the president has affairs with interns.
Right.
That's what presidents do.
Why is this on the news? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so I think they're always, they're always surprised at how naive the Americans seem to be or how much we expect from people that we probably shouldn't.
Well, there's a big split, between people when they look at Christ. Is Christ perfect? Or is the important thing that he was also a man, and we do the same thing with Babe Ruth and with Gandhi and with all these great icons. We want to see them as perfect because they're icons.
Yeah.
But as you're saying, it's important and mature thing to also value their humanity.
Well, and it's funny, early on, they would never show Jesus in movies. It was very controversial how he would be being portrayed. And the first time that I saw a movie that had a Jesus character in it, and he was sweaty and he was shouting and he was dynamic, I'm saying, this is not the person I saw, on the cross in wood.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize he was human. But it does make it difficult for people to factor that into it, how a very good person in some ways can be a very terrible person in something else. You know, they don't have to be nice guys.
Let's talk a little bit. Well, I'm hoping that this delves into an area that we can discuss. I'm curious about the playing surfaces of the various sports as the mythical arena, if you will, where these quote-unquote gladiators play, regardless of sport. And we can throw golf in there. We can throw whatever sport we want in there. And in terms of how that ties into this whole mythological, because even places where games are played become legendary.
Well, we got the right person on the line for that question. John wrote a book called Fenway Park, A Salute to the Coolest, Cruelest, Longest-Running Major League Baseball Stadium in America. And I would argue, and I'll let you further the argument, John, that Fenway Park may be one of the most mythic environments of any sports arenas in the world maybe today, but especially in Major League Baseball. So what do you think that the park brings to what it is to be a fan, what it is to be a Red Sox fan?
Well, the one thing about Fenway is it's intimate. It's really close and tight in. You can see players' faces in a way that you can't, for example, in the much bigger ballparks. So it does get a connection between – they can hear what you shout at them. So, you know, in a big park, you can't hear anything. Here, if you yell something at the third baseman or the right fielder, he's going to hear you. So it makes the fan a participant in a way that he or she would not be in a bigger park. Also, I don't know if you've been to Fenway, but from the outside, it's the same as it looked in 1912.
Wow.
It looks like an old brick factory, and you walk in, and it's the same view that they had. It's been rebuilt.
Right.
But it's the same view that my grandfather had.
And they still change the numbers on the scoreboard, if not by hand. They're still mechanical, right?
They are still by hand.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yep. Now, I'm sure you've been to the Bob at least once to see the D-backs play.
Yep.
I've been there a couple times. It's the only professional baseball stadium I have ever been to. And I have sat up in the cheap seats, the nosebleed section, way in the back behind left field. I've also sat 12 or 22 rows directly behind home plate. And my buddy and I were actually calling the pitches as we saw them, which was absolutely amazing. But we were still a fair distance away from the field.
Yep.
And my dad, normally dad takes the son to the ball game, right? Well, of course, didn't have a team until 98, okay? And so in 99 or 2000, whatever it was, I took my dad to go see a ball game. Now, he has a poor vision, so we ended up going into one of the restaurants along outfield, behind a center field, to watch the game on a TV screen. But I still felt like I was a part of the game because I was still in the stadium. I was still in.
Yeah, you're in the atmosphere.
In the atmosphere. Let's talk a little bit about these ballparks, not only in terms of history like Fenway and so forth, but also in terms of what energy is generated there by both the players as well as the fans. And sometimes you can feel the players and the team energy, especially if they're losing as opposed to winning.
And feel free to slide into what it's like at the international sports.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think, especially, and this is why one reason, for example, in Boston, they like to keep these buildings around, is that in terms of noise generators, they're unbelievable. The old Boston Garden, the place would shake because there was this vertical cockpit. You'd have two or three levels, and you'd be right on top of the action. We badly missed the old Yankee Stadium. We love Wrigley Field. So I think the more intimate you can get and the louder it gets, it's what's interesting. I mean, one thing, for example, you may have seen Spain was playing yesterday against Chile in the World Cup. In Maracana Stadium in Rio, the 200,000 people can get into that stadium.
Whoa. Wow. Gosh. I bet it felt intimate.
It does. Well, you know, a lot of it is, how is it constructed? Is it mm-hmm. built to have people on top of the action? Because those places will become noisier and noisier. So I think architecture has a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. Also helps if you have a pretty good team.
Yeah, right.
I remember when I was growing up, the Red Sox were terrible. You'd have 4,000 or 5,000 people in that place.
Now, I have to go a sidebar here with you a little bit, John, in regards to baseball diamonds. The one thing that has always frustrated me about the stats, especially when it comes to home runs, mm-hmm. is the fact that from home plate to first to second to third to home, it's exactly the same in every single park in the universe.
That's right.
But when you get into the outfield, there is no... a warning track that is exactly the same distance from third base and first base out or second base out. Every field has a different length.
Yeah.
And it drives me nuts when I hear about these home runs that are hit by these guys. But it's like, well, what does that mean? Because the Bob's only 200 feet and Wrigley's 600 feet and Yankee is 900 feet. What does that mean?
Actually, I think Yankee's like 12 feet.
Well, but you see where I'm going. It's like the dimensions of a baseball diamond are 90 by 90 by 90 by 90.
Yeah,
that's right.
But the outfield can be anything you want.
Does that add to the game?
And, yeah. Well, for example, it really affects it in Boston.
Yep.
Because of the outfield wall, the green monster, mm-hmm. you can hit a ball that would be a routine fly ball any of the places you mentioned, and it's over the fence.
Of course, you can hit a 500-foot line drive, and it's not making it over.
That's also true.
Yeah.
Well, and then, for example, we always said that Joe DiMaggio, played for the Yankees, would have been a better hitter in Boston, and Ted Williams would have been a better hitter in Yankee Stadium. And if, as a matter of fact, what the Red Sox have always done here is you build a team for the ballpark.
Yeah.
You have right-handed hitters that can clear the wall. If the wall were 500 feet away, we would have a different team.
And baseball is the only sport, with the exception of golf, that has different dimension stadiums. Football, the dimensions of the playing field are mm-hmm. exactly the same. Hockey, basketball, and so forth. From watching the statistics, that just frustrates the bitch. And then, of course, you probably remember what year it was, John, when they accused the baseball manufacturers of juicing up the balls. And the reality is that no two seasons of balls are going to be the same because the materials are affected by weather conditions, et cetera, et cetera. They're never the same. I don't care how they can make them close, but they're not always exact.
No, as a matter of fact, we saw this. If you wanted to see the all-time contrast, the 2007 World Series between the Colorado Rockies and the Red Sox, you're playing at Fenway Park, which is basically in a swamp, okay, downtown, and you're playing at in Denver, where it's the air is so thin
right.
that they put the balls in a humidor. There was a baseball humidor in Denver so that the balls aren't flying all over the place.
They still seem to fly all over the place.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, early on, people were saying nothing in this ballpark should count.
So, especially the pitchers, I'm sure.
No home run should count, right?
Well, I want to move a little past baseball, but before we do,
go for it.
I've got to ask one question just because I can't miss this opportunity. Chipper Jones, my favorite player of all time. Do you ever have a chance to interview Chipper?
I did not. You know why? He's National League and we are American League.
Oh, man.
I've never played them.
Well, I was also want to ask Richard, you have a favorite baseball player you want to ask him about?
The only one I can think of that I enjoyed watching and playing and hating at the same time in baseball specifically was Reggie Jackson. Because when I was a kid growing up, I was a Dodger fan. In Phoenix, we had a radio station and that's what they carried was Dodger ball. And so I became a Dodger fan from that standpoint until we got the D-backs. So Reggie Jackson was always an interesting fella. Now, I'm just curious, do you think that, because I haven't heard anything from him or about him since he retired from baseball, would you say that he has sort of lived up to that mythical quality?
By stepping back a little bit?
Yeah, well, you know, people, in a way, people don't want to be close to those people. In a way, you don't really want to find out. I remember one thing that early in my career, I went into the Red Sox clubhouse for the first time. I hadn't done baseball. and didn't know what the clubhouse etiquette was, that you only can talk to the players at certain times of the year. So I go up to Carl Yastrzemski, who was an icon of my youth, and I asked him a question, and he bit my head off. It was unbelievable. And I said, oh, wait a minute. So suddenly I have to say, well, did I just catch him at a bad moment, or is the guy that I always idolized really like this all the time? I think sometimes you don't really want to know because you like this thing. And now, of course, Reggie was very different. One thing that made Reggie's mythology was his nickname, Mr. October.
Mr. October, right? Yes.
He did things when it counted in the World Series. Remember, he had three home runs in one game?
Yes, yes. Yeah. I think that was in Yankee Stadium, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Yeah.
Against the Dodgers, correct?
Against the Dodgers.
And I think Steve Garvey was the first baseman.
Yeah.
And Steve said later, after he went by me, I was way around the bases, when I thought no one was looking, I applauded into my glove.
Oh, wow.
Those stories are so much, take us so far beyond baseball.
Yeah. Absolutely.
This is where these human stories, these levels of human respect and admiration, this is the reason why I wanted to talk with you on this show about mythology, because that's where human excellence really does become a mythic thing on sports fields.
I want to ask. Go ahead, John.
Oh, you know, it's also, before I forget it, I remember talking to Tommy Heinsohn, who was a great Celtic player and the coach here. We were debating one night, actually chatting about why people were so entranced by sports. He said, it's entertainment that's in doubt.
Yeah, you don't know who's going to win.
Yeah.
Yeah. Plus, you know what? There is a catharsis. It's a Greek play. There is this buildup of tension. It builds up, and then there is a catharsis. Win or lose, there is a result, and it's over, and people leave feeling satisfied. That's why Americans hate tie games. There's no catharsis at the end of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me ask you about, and this transcends all sports. We're not going to just focus on baseball in this question. What about your perspective on the level of loyalty of a player to a team? Now, it used to be that you could be, but now with the way the whole system
free
is set up,
and everything.
You can't say, look, I want to be a Dodger, or I want to be a Phoenix Sun, or I want to be an LA King hockey player, and I want to spend my entire career there because that's what I grew up rooting for, and that's where I want to play.
You don't have the same local boys of your team.
How does that change the mythology of these iconic heroes in the minds of the fans, or even in your mind, John?
Well, my mind, again, I understand it's a business. And also, when I was growing up, Ted Williams was a Red Sox player because of the reserve clause. He couldn't go anyplace else.
Yeah.
There's a reason why guys stuck around for 40 years, because nobody would trade them. So now, I remember Dick Young was a great New York Daily News sports writer. And he told the fans, you're rooting for a city's name on a shirt. That's what it is. You're not rooting for the city of New York. We have more than one team here. So let's make straight what we have here. But I know in Boston, and I'm sure elsewhere, when players leave here and come back in a different uniform, they are the enemy. It happened to Johnny Damon. It happened to Wade Boggs. It happened to Roger Clemens. It happened to Jacoby Ellsbury this year, especially if you go to the Yankees.
Yeah, right. If you go to the rivals.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, if you go to the rival, the only time I did not see that happen was Ray Bourque, who was the Bruins captain for years and years, and on teams that really weren't that competitive.
Yeah.
And he finally, near the end of his career, they traded him to Colorado because he wanted to have a chance to win, and he wins the Stanley Cup, which they hadn't won here at that point since 1972.
Yeah.
And Ray comes back to Boston, to City Hall, and he shows him the Stanley Cup. And the feeling was, good for you, Ray, because there was, he was the face of the Bruins, he was the captain, and he deserves something good to happen to him.
We feel that way about David Ross in Boston, by the way. The Braves fans feel that way about David Ross going to Boston, by the way.
Oh, and you know what? They love David Ross here.
Love him.
Okay. Now, I remember as a Phoenix Sun fan, I could not believe that they actually brought in, first of all, Danny Ainge, a guy I hated on the Celtics when we played him. He was just the worst. But, boy, as soon as he started playing, I love Danny Ainge.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I'm going, Okay, getting Charles Barkley, that is the biggest mistake we have ever made, based upon, again, his history with the Sixers. And it's like, wow, he took us all the way to game six of the 93 finals, you know, against the Bulls. I mean, it was incredible, that particular team. But it's just one of those things where I guess it sort of has to grow on you a little bit.
I heard a great theory from a drunk man at a bar in Newcastle. It was actually a Newcastle bar when I was there watching a Newcastle football soccer game in England with my brother Garrison. And he said that since soccer players have started changing teams and stuff, you haven't had the same physical violence that you once had around soccer, football hooligans, and violence come up around the teams because, for obvious reasons. And I think that's
interesting.
It's worth noting.
Yeah, yeah,
that's right. Well, also because of the movement, you look in England back when I was growing up, only Englishmen played in the English Premier League.
Uh huh.
And now you look at who are the best players; they're not Englishmen.
Right.
And
very
I think
interesting.
So it's much harder to relate to a team that doesn't have guys from your area.
Does that make international sports more exciting and nationalistic because there's no free agency in international sports?
It does. But you know what also it was interesting? You're talking about an icon. I talked with Pelé the other day via Skype, of all things.
Uh-huh.
He was a great Brazilian player. And we were talking when they won the World Cup in 1970, every Brazilian player played in Brazil for a club team there.
Yeah.
And he said, we knew what each other would do. We knew plus the fans knew us well.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Brazilian players are in 12 different countries. Only two field players from this team play in Brazil. No one knows these guys. And when they get back together, they don't play the old Brazilian style because they're playing all sorts of styles.
Right.
You know, you get the guy in England is playing an English style game. The guy in Germany is playing that game.
Interesting.
So what you've lost now is the national characteristic in soccer that you always had before.
So free Here's agency has affected international sports too.
Yeah. I mean, for example, one reason why Spain was beaten so badly, that team was exhausted. You had guys playing in the European Champions League. Remember, it was the two Madrid teams playing.
Right.
Those guys had about 2 weeks off.
Jeez.
They were absolutely drained, which didn't happen in the old days.
Well, it works for us. Just kidding.
Sports in particular, I've even heard the phrase that it's the most important, unimportant activity that goes on the planet. I mean, certainly for the players, it's important. For the clubs, on the business side of it, obviously, it's important because they're trying to generate money. And, for example, not to go too far into this particular one, but we touched upon it in our segment, John, where this whole business with the Clippers owner, that if this thing hadn't gone public, no one would ever have known, and it would have never gone this direction, and he would still have his team.
Ooh.
By the same token, I've heard comments that, well, wait a minute, I thought this was we had freedom of speech here.
Right.
You know, I mean, the guy has the freedom to be an idiot.
Well, he would have had
so
the freedom
forth.
To keep the team, too, but the players would have had the freedom to not
Well,
show
but then
up.
The other aspect of it is that the NBA in particular was looking at just the bottom line.
Right.
You know, they didn't care about whether this recording was gotten legally or not, or whether he believed what he was saying or not. It was, you know, if we don't do something here, he's going to cost the NBA, and let alone the Clippers, millions of dollars in revenue from ticket sales, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts, John?
That's right. Well, and also one thing that should be pointed out, they loved Donald Sterling for years because he had a terrible team.
Huh.
If you played the Clippers, it was a guaranteed win.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, they loved him.
Yeah.
Huh.
So I think in this case, that was definitely a bottom line decision. And what happens especially is once sponsors start bailing on you, once they start saying, I mean, here's, for example, what would happen with the Washington Redskins. Once sponsors start saying, we won't be affiliated with your team anymore because of this, then you guarantee it would be the Washington something else.
Yeah.
It would not be the Redskins.
Yeah, please don't call them the Senators, though. Or the congressman.
Hard to get fans, huh?
It'll be even harder.
So we may only have like 10 minutes left or so, and Richard asked us a standard set of questions at the end about you, but I wanted to ask just kind of real generally, just to get in some of the best stuff while we have the chance. Maybe one of your favorite interviews or interview moments or interviewees. You interviewed Pele. I think my brother told me you interviewed. Did you interview JFK or did you have play cards with Castro?
You know what would happen? We were down in 1991. We were in Havana.
Uh-huh.
The Pan American Games were supposed to be there, and they were not ready at all. So the Cubans were called us down. Some of the media said, "You know, why don't you have a look? We will give you a tour, and then you'll see that we're better prepared than you think we are." So we were there for a couple of days, and suddenly we're hanging around, and in walks Fidel. Castro walks in. And we ended up having a two-hour conversation with him about everything from Major League Baseball to the embargo. Huh. And in the middle of it, one of his aides walks in, and it was the night the Gulf War began in Kuwait.
Oh, yeah.
Suddenly I said, here I'm talking to a dictator of a socialist country who's not going to be on our side on this one.
Oh, man.
And we ended up getting this entire, hour-long riff, from Fidel and talking about the evil fruits of capitalism. But what struck me about it, there were only about seven or eight of us in the room. If we asked him a question, he would kind of crane his neck to make eye contact with us, to be able to see and talk to him. So meanwhile, we need to be getting back to Miami, and we're getting nervous because the flight time's coming up. And one of his aides says, no problem. He says, the flight will leave when Fidel says it leaves. But it was but that's what's been interesting about the job, is to go places that you would never go and talk to people that you would never talk to. I remember one thing was really telling. The World Cup in Germany in 2006 was in Berlin, in the stadium that Adolf Hitler built. And Germany was playing at home. And one of their first substitute off the bench was an immigrant from Nigeria. And I'm saying, here is one of the Untermenschen that Hitler didn't even consider human, and he's going to save the national team from defeat in the stadium that Adolf Hitler built. And you see how this can change in one or two generations. The younger generation of Germans was painting their faces and cheering for the national team. They never used to do that. It was not considered good.
Yeah. Well, how much sports, there have been moments in sports that really do seem to have impacted the world and impacted cultural history. I mean, you think of that moment with the black glove. You think of, even some of Pele's successes. And I don't mean just the heroism like Babe Ruth or something like that, but I mean some serious events that get acknowledged on the world scale, a world stage. Or maybe what it really is that things like racism sometimes play out on the international stage through sports.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting? I did a story this year in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombings last year.
Yeah.
And the Red Sox out of nowhere won the World Series. And they won it in Boston, which they had not done for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at, and I found five or six instances like that where how a team did affected the way the entire region or the entire country felt.
Totally.
They identified. You look at the Japanese women beating the Americans in the World Cup. First time an Asian team had done it. Right, maybe 4 months after the earthquake and the tsunami ravaged, in some cases, their own hometowns.
Hmm.
Look at the New Orleans Saints, who played in the Superdome, which was a house of horror.
Those things make you want to cry.
Oh, yeah. And they came back, and they won the first game. They won the first game back in the Dome a year later. Remember, they were gone for a year.
Yeah, I watched.
And there was a blocked punt on the fourth play, and the Saints get a touchdown. They have a statue outside the Superdome of that play.
Mm.
Or you look at the We Are Marshall. The whole Marshall football team died in a plane crash. And they were going to cancel the program. And no. They got the team back together. They won the first game the next year. And the players came out after having showered. Everybody was still in the stands.
Wow.
I have to say, too, that
see how people relate to you look at the Miracle on Ice in 1980.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone knows where they were.
I remember. I can hear Al Michaels in my ear right now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, here's a sport nobody knows much about, and no one knew any of those guys.
Yeah. But everybody got pulled in.
Right. Now this I think this is still related to what you're talking about. This kind of can go in that list, but it's a little backwards. 2001 World Series, the Yankees. We had just gone through 9/11.
Yep.
Right.
And it was in November we were playing, the first time ever that we played the World Series in November. And you thought, you know, the Yankees ought to win.
Yeah. Should people feel that way? Yeah.
And they didn't.
Nope.
And I thought, you know what? That actually is appropriate.
Yeah.
Because they don't need that celebration and stuff going on. In as much as people probably would have liked to have had it to help bolster the morale, my perspective from what I have learned of New Yorkers, they don't need any bolstering of morale. They can do that just fine on their own.
On the other hand, you know, I remember Chipper Jones talking about I think the best loss of his career was they played the Mets in the Mets' first game after September 11th, and they lost that game, and I don't think any of the Braves felt bad about that loss. Not that they didn't try, but, you know.
Exactly. But, I mean, you have those benchmarks.
It was interesting that year. I was in New York then for that. I actually saw Mo Rivera throw the ball away.
Wow.
I was there for the New York City Marathon, which for them was a much more emotional event than the World Series because the entire city was being – was showing it was resolute.
Oh, yes.
You're not going to stop this thing from happening. We're going to do it.
Yeah.
Hmm. And there were many people running who were relatives of people who had died in 9/11. You had some police and firemen who had been there. They were running.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a global event. You had athletes coming from all over the world to show that life would go on.
Yeah, now that's interesting because this all ties into the whole mythological story or what mythology and the stories within it are about in terms of having those tragedies and how people face them.
Totally. You know, and this is something that reporters, somebody's had to cover these stories forever. We're talking all the way back to the Egyptian scribes letting the Egyptians know how they did in their wars against, in the Middle East. Like, there has been records and recording and reporting is a time-honored tradition, and it's something we do that professionals do, but it's also when a little baby goes to the mother and tells her about the boo-boo, that is the beginning of reporting, you know?
It is,
And or when an old man is telling about the stories of his life. Reporting is something that we all do, and it's essential. And it's really, over the years, developed its own kind of character. The reporter, I think of April from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. She's the archetypal reporter, and the reporter is become... a real living character and archetype in our world, and I just feel like it's really worth acknowledging how ancient this role truly is, and yet how living it always has been.
Well, and you know what's interesting now is back before visual media, it was oral history.
Mm-hmm.
Someone had to tell you about someone who lived in the 19th century. Now, if I tell someone about Pelé or Bob Cousy or Babe Ruth, they can YouTube those guys.
Mm-hmm.
You can see them in a way that you couldn't see them before. In a way, though, it makes them more human because it's easy to mythologize people you can't see.
Absolutely.
Mm.
I have to take your word for it. I mean,
yeah.
You look back, for example, at Goliath. How big was Goliath anyway?
I don't know, but because we don't know, we can imagine him huge.
Yeah. Well, and you know what was interesting is when you go back to the days before television, and it was all radio, and it was in the descriptive quality of the announcer, that's why Yankee Stadium always seemed like a cathedral.
Hmm.
You know, because you'd always been told about it and it seemed that way.
Hmm.
But I remember there was a funny story when they were first showing Major League Baseball on TV. And Kurt Gowdy, who was the Red Sox announcer for years, he was the number two TV guy behind Mel Allen in New York. And Mel had been the ultimate radio guy. So they're doing the first game on TV.
Todd Presnell pitched. I met him, by the way.
Who met Mel Allen?
I met Todd Presnell, who pitched in that first televised game.
Ah.
Yeah.
So you love the story then. So meanwhile, Mel is broadcasting it as though it's still a radio game.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, after the second inning, Kurt turns to Mel and says, Mel, They can see the guy.
Well, that's sort of the reverse of what the...
That changed, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I've seen you. You do video clips now online.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, is that once they can see you, it's a more intimate medium, but in a way it changes the mythology of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because now you can't build a tall tale, as they used to say.
John, let me ask you, how important do you see your role in all of this? And we'll go ahead and put sports as an important subject that needs to be covered. We won't argue that point. It's part of our lives and livelihoods in many ways. How important is do you see your what where do you place yourself, if you will? And again, we all could go with our ego kind of stuff, but you've had to have thought about this. That, gee, you know, I'm keeping records here. This is important stuff that I need to be doing.
Well, it's funny. I most felt that way when I was watching The Miracle on Ice. And I said, this is going to be a game people will talk about for generations. You have to get this right.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be cheering. Not that I would anyway, but there were people there who were.
Yeah.
You can't be a fan. You are an observer. So the one thing that I certainly know, and it's more true now than ever, that the athletes are separated, I have access. So I have a privilege and an obligation to go and talk to people that the fan can't talk to. They can't get in the clubhouse. To bear witness as well as you can. And also now to put it in perspective, what does this really mean, what you just saw? To have some kind of history. But mostly what we're doing about sports, the reason why we like it is that human effort, human resilience, daring, all of those things come out on the athletic field. I mean, the reason why we like it is it shows us we like to think our best qualities. That's why we root for the underdog. Because it shows. I remember Michael Ruzioni told me, he said he was getting letters from people after they beat the Soviets saying, I was going to commit suicide and I've changed my mind. You showed me that there's a reason for hope.
Wow.
Or you have inspired me. You know, you have shown me that it doesn't have to be this way. Remember people where there was a famous Olympic athlete who came in. Oh, he was running the marathon. He came in about 6 hours. And people said, why didn't you just drop out? He said, my country did not send me to start the race. They sent me to finish the race. And those are always the most heartrending Olympic stories are the people who, came from nothing, from
the
countries you never
runners.
Heard of, from incredible poverty and did amazing things. And it also crossed one reason why. I mean, I knew something was up here when Americans are rooting for a Soviet gymnast, Olga Korban. You know?
Do you ever sort of resent being in the position you're in because you can't really be the fan because you have to be in that neutral observational mode?
No, I think that's something that you know that you give up when you do it. And also, once you've done it from the inside, it's hard being a fan. Because when you're a fan, you are rooting for the idea of people that the reality may be quite different. You know, it may well be, you saw this with the Red Sox team a couple of years ago, the infamous chicken and beer team. There were some awful people on that team, just like bad guys.
Yeah, needed traded.
Yeah, and exactly. And it was very hard to root for those people. I mean, emotionally, do I root? Well, what I like to say is I root for the story. Whatever the most interesting story, the most interesting outcome, that's what I root for.
Yeah.
And to be honest, yesterday, I didn't know if I was going to write or not. On the Spain match, but Spain losing, that's an interesting story.
Yeah.
When the champions lose. Oh, by the way, on the same day the Spanish king defects or not, he abdicates, their team is booted out of the World Cup. So the kings of world soccer go down the same day. That
yeah. And just with a little American pride, because we should wrap up here. But with a little American pride, I just want to point out that Spain, when they tied Brazil for the longest international winning streak in history, it was the United States that beat that streak and took it from Spain.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, one interesting thing is the Americans, we love to think of ourselves as underdogs.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, because that's a great point. Yeah.
Well, actually, it's sort of
soccer is like the best. We're the only one we can think that way about ourselves. That's great.
Well, but it's
I don't know what Americans would do if the Americans ever won the World Cup. we would be like Alexander the Great. I mean, we would have to cry because there were no more worlds to conquer.
Right, right.
Yeah, but at the same time, there are also those who are always touting, you know, America number one, number one, number one. And it's like, well, okay, you're going to have to prove that on the field.
Right.
Or you're going to have to prove that on the court because unless you do, like they did on the ice in 1980, you know, that's a nice saying.
Well, so, you're right. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that always kind of made me laugh here as a Bostonian, you go into Boston Garden and there are all these championship banners of the Celtics, world champions. 1960.
Yeah.
I said, wait a minute. 1/3 of your league is in New York State.
Right. Yeah. Well, and this is a temptation I'm going to have to fight off, but I really would maybe another time love to ask you what you think about the future of international baseball, because the commissioner has made announcements that they want to make some moves, and I'm very curious what's going to happen.
Ooh, very interesting. Absolutely. I haven't heard that yet.
But I know we're pushing over to our time limit. So and Richard likes to wrap it up in his ways. So we better do that.
Well, John, it's been great having you on the program, and obviously to revisit a lot of the memories that both Will and I have, as well as you, of our favorite sporting events and the things that have happened around them. It's become integral in our lives, sports, whatever the sports might be. And the people who play those games, you know, I mentioned golf before, and I think the players that I remember, like Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, Fuzzy Zeller, there was one guy, Greg Norman, I was going to say the Shark, but it's Greg Norman, and so on and so forth. And I also produce on this station a program called The Golf Radio Show, and of course they're always chiding me about how I know nothing about golf. I've been producing this show for 6 years, and I believe it or not, I've learned an awful lot about golf.
Without a club, huh?
Well, I've only taken one lesson, but apparently I learned a lot because I did pretty darn good on that one lesson, according to the instructor. But all of this is still a part of our lives. As I quoted before, someone said, you know, it's the most important unimportant
right.
activity that we've got, but it is important because it's not just the games that are on TV or on the radio or that we go and watch in person. But it's an outlet for both us as the fan. And by the way, that was an area I did want to get into, and that the fans are rooting for their team, and when their team wins, the fans almost take credit
projection
for the win. They didn't do a damn thing. You know?
It's not how I feel about it.
but that'll have to be saved for another day. But it is integral. And for you, even more so, because you're covering it 24/7 practically. And globally because of the internet now. And that's extraordinary. So one of the questions that I like to wrap up the program with, and I ask you to answer this in any way, whatever comes to your mind first. Who is John Powers?
Who is John Powers? it's funny. I like to think of myself as a Renaissance man. I've only covered sports about half my time in journalism. And I remember interviewing the guy that dropped the bomb on Nagasaki.
Wow.
And I said, wow. And I remember interviewing the guy that was Gus Hall. He was the former head of the Communist Party that J. Edgar Hoover put in jail next to Machine Gun Kelly. So, you know what I tell my classmates? I am Huck Finn with a laptop.
I like that.
And I want to point out, just because some of the listeners may be hopefully a little mythologically oriented, I want to point out one of the books you wrote on Boston dialects and accents, which play a huge role in culture and myth. And so as you're highlighting your Renaissance man qualities, I definitely want to point out that you spent a whole book on dialect and language.
It was wicked bizarre.
I love that. Hey, John, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you do?
I think the idea is if you can share what I see and maybe enlighten the reader a little bit about what it's really like inside where they can't go. I think people always ask me, what was your greatest thrill? I said, you know what? Walking into the Red Sox clubhouse for the first time as a journalist. It's the one place you wonder. Everything else I can see, I couldn't, until now, I could not really see what this is like. I couldn't see what the ball players are like, when they're not on the field.
And finally, who inspires you?
Who inspires me? Interesting question. Well, he's not around anymore, but my father did. Always. It was a privilege, actually. I wrote his obituary for the Boston Globe. Because his big thing was, when he told me when I was a kid, I don't care what you do, just make sure you do it as well as you can. Try to be the best at what you do as you can do. And it's given me respect for what everybody else does, and also a feeling that if I can do what I do well, then he'll be happy.
Cool. He must be.
Wow. That's awesome. Thank you, John.
Thanks so much.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next month, end of July, for part 7 of Myth of Sophia, I'm Richard Dugan. Love to Lal.
Namath back to pass. Joe looking, throwing, and it's completed on the 47-yard line. To Sowry is brought down immediately. George Sowry at the 47, brought down by Rick Volk. The safety, Unitas, goes back to pass. He's in the pocket. Unitas throwing for the end zone. It is intercepted in the end zone by Randy Beverly. He down. Unitas goes back to pass. 2 seconds, 1 second. Unitas throwing to Richardson. He has the ball in the 49, brought down by Sample. The clock has run out, and the ball game is over. There is the gun, and the Jets are champions of the football world.
Nolan Ryan, who came in the ball game with the Mets behind 2-0 in the third. And the pitch back, a curve, topped out to third. Garrett has the ball, a throw to first. And the Mets are the National League champion.
Clendenin is just one good stride in from the outfield grass at first. 2-1 pitch, fly ball, deep left field. Jones is back to the fence. Jones is on the warning track. The World Series is over. Jones makes the catch.
Each of the four men will swim the pool two lengths. Up and back, backstroke, breaststroke, butterfly, freestyle. And there's a close-up look at Mark Spitz churning furiously through the water, heading for the final 25 meters. And he will give the lead over to Jerry Heidenreich of Dallas, Texas, who will swim the ankle leg or freestyle. So Mark Spitz has built the lead to about a body length. And it's going to be a fight for second place, but Heidenreich has put them all away in the ankle leg. It's now a question of how much time it'll take him. We're looking at a new world record, no question about it. Mark Spitz has 7 gold medals. He's won everything that he had hoped to win.
Secretariat has opened a 22-length lead. He is going to be the Triple Crown winner. Here comes Secretariat to the wire. An unbelievable, an amazing performance. He hits the finish 25 lengths in front. It's going to be Kreitzer for a second, My Gallant third, Private Smiles fourth, and Sham, who had it today, dropped back to fifth.
How I hugged my daddy when he gave me that old baseball glove. I think I slept with it that night. I loved it so much. I wonder if Hank Aaron started out that way. Dreaming of the big leagues and the Hall of Fame. I'm going to the place where baseball. And Cobb and Joe DiMaggio. Sunny days and Willie Mays. You'll be glad you took the trip to Cooperstown, the town where baseball lives. A ball and some kids in an empty lot. We play till mama call. Hey, hurry home, it's getting dark. I read about the big train and Rogers Hornsby. They're part of America, and they're part. Thank you.
been Joe DiMaggio. Sunny days and Willie Mays, you'll be glad you took the trip to Cooperstown, the town where baseball lives. Sunny days and Willie Mays, you'll be glad you took Cooperstown, the town where baseball lives.